Father Yvonne Gwynn from Detroit, a real good welcome. Thank you.
I really feel at home because they got Bill sitting beside me, and I'm from Detroit. Here's three stories about the guys who went to heaven. There's an Irishman, a Jewish man, and a black man. And heaven was full, and the Irishman got up there, and St. Peter said, "Hell, it's full, you can't get in." He says, "What do you mean I can't get in? I've lived for the faith, I've done everything for God, I've gone through persecutions, I've fought the North Ireland, everything like that." He said, "You gotta let me in, I've done everything for the Lord." He says, "Okay, I'll make you a deal. Spell God and you can come in." And the Irishman goes, "G-O-D." He says, "Okay, come on in." The Jewish man comes up, he says, St. Peter says, "Sorry, you can't get in, it's all full." He says, "What do you mean?" He said, "We're the chosen race. We're the ones who started. We've come from the Old Testament. Our Lord Jesus Christ was a Jew. We've done everything for the faith." That's pretty impressive. He says, "Okay, I'll make you a deal. Spell God and you can come in." The Jewish gentleman went, G-O-D, says, "Come on in." The black man gets up there and he says, "Sorry," St. Peter says, "sorry, we're all full." He says, "What do you mean you're all full?" He said, "There's no race in this world that's been persecuted more than we have. And now you're going to tell me I can't come in." St. Peter says, "Yeah, that's true. All right, same deal. Spell chrysanthemum and you can come in." I'm like the young priest who forgot what the hell he was supposed to say. This young priest, he always forgot what he was supposed to say. He could never remember the sermons. And he'd get up there and he'd stumble and stutter and keep reviewing things. Everybody kept falling asleep on him. And they kept yawning and shuffling away and everything else. And the bishop came to him and he says, "Father, you're having a hell of a time with your sermons, aren't you?" He says, Yes, Your Excellency, I am. He says, "Look, you've got to get the people's attention." He says, "The next time you get up there, say, 'I am in love with a woman.'" And he says, "They'll all perk up. Watch. They all get on the edge of their seat. And tell them you think of the woman all day long. She's absolutely beautiful. She's gorgeous. You can't get her out of her mind." And then after 10 minutes, you tell them, "And the woman is the Blessed Virgin Mother." So the young priest gets up and he says, "My dear friends, I have an announcement to make to you. The bishop is in love with a woman." He thinks of her all day long. She's absolutely beautiful, gorgeous. He can't get her off her mind. He thinks of her all of the time. And for the life of me, I can't remember her name. I could go on like this all night long, but we better get down to some work. I want to thank the people who invited me out here. It was real fun coming out on the plane. I'm sitting in the plane between two guys and the pilot comes back and it says, "Engine number 3 is gone. Our estimated arrival time will be a half an hour later." And then about 25 minutes later they go, "Engine number 4 is gone. Our estimated arrival time is going to be an hour later." One guy sitting beside me turns to me and says, "Jesus, if those other two engines go out, we'll be up here all day." Thanks, all the clean jokes I know. Well, I really love the church, and I think that it's just magnificent, all the changes, but I am the only priest in the Roman Catholic Church who doesn't like any of the changes from Second Vatican II. And the reason is because nobody knew I had a drinking problem until we started saying Mass in English. All right, I'm not going to bore you with any ounce by ounce, drink by drink, event by event of what happened to me when I was drinking, because I had a perfectly normal childhood for 31 years. And I grew up in Montreal, Canada, unbeknownst to me, qualifying for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with the ability to outdrink everybody and anybody right under the table. I never woke up with 1,000 Arabs tromping through my tummy in their bare feet. My head never felt like it was 9 feet across. My tongue never felt like the 79th Cavalry just rolled over it. And I just felt great. All my friends were always dying the next morning. And I felt great. And they said, well, that's really good. You're really mature. And I believed them. And I went through all the normal things which I was a young little rich kid. That's the other thing I had against me. They used to pour me into a little Eton suit every Sunday morning with buttons on the fly. And once they locked you in that thing, you're locked in all day long. Until I had a nanny of more until I was 19. Take me out of it. I had a St. Bernard dog. And now I'm mature. I have 5 St. Bernard dogs. But that's... And I did all the normal things you do in Montreal. I played hockey, and I was in the Montreal Canadian organization. And all kinds of things were going on. And by the time I was 21, when Montreal high schools in those days were 4 years long, and I was there for 8 years. I was there, I played my last hockey game, then I had 6 scholarships, didn't take one of them, and went in. My father said, you want to go to medical school? I said, yes, I did. And for the next 3 years, that's where I was. And that came very boring because all the men wanted to do there was marry rich women and make a lot of money. And I'd come out of that background. I didn't like it. So I went in advertising agency for a year because I thought that was a good place to drink. And I didn't like that very much. So I retired at the age of 23. I retired. And I haven't had a real job since. I went to Europe to ingratiate them with my presence because this continent, the United States, was not enough things were happening. And I think I was in one of those melancholy, Irish, soppy drinks where there's about 500 people in the room and you're crying in your beer. And I decided what I was going to do with my life. I'll give my life to God. That's what I decided. That will really wow them. And so they accepted me, the clowns, you know. And on August the 10th, 1956, I flew home from London, England, and I went to the estate. And on August the 11th, I got in my own Cadillac convertible that had 3,000 miles on it, brand spanking new, and drove to the novitiate to give my life to God and stumbled in. And I threw the keys to my brother and said, get thee behind me, Satan, where dust and rust and moth will take thee apart. And there I was. And I stayed there a year, and I found out what the novitiate was for in a religious order. I'm an oblate father, O-M-I, after my name. You know, it means you're a classy religious priest. What it really means is other people's money incorporated, because I got the vow of poverty, and you people live by it, see? And that's what that means. But I found out what that was about. That's where you separate the men from the boys. The men went home. But I loved every minute of it because you never talked. You're in silence all the time. And that was great. You couldn't fight and nobody got on your nerves. And 4 years later, I took final vows. So that's really big time in the oblates, boy. You tie the noose around your neck for life, you know. And it was a very great, egotistical, self-aggrandizing experience. Everybody's crying, and my mother was crying. My own father had passed away then. Everybody's singing all these Latin songs to you, and they put the big oblate cross under your cincture, and 4 girlfriends committed suicide, and it was really quite nice. I was greatly impressed. And then 4 more years later, I was called to the priesthood, and I was ordained. And for those 8 years, I never took a drink, not because of any type of personnel prowess or any type of control or any type of virtue. It was just in the society in which I was living, there was no booze. Now, I had also acquired, being excessive compulsive, I always compete against people, about 7 more degrees after my name. And now I return to Montreal, Canada, for Ottawa for the first time in 8 years, really, truly, as a brandly new ordained Roman Catholic priest, believing that our Lord did a, well, so-so adequate job when he walked on the face of the earth, but the real promised Messiah had just come upon his people. What alcoholism to me is a loss of control and a conflict between behavior and values in the drinker. And as soon as I went home, I was invited to go to St. Mary's Hospital, where I had gone with my little Eton suit, strapped into it, in a top hat, gray gloves, a cane, and a St. Bernard dog. From the time I was about 5 till the time I was about 14. And they asked me to go back there to say Mass for the repose of the soul of my father. Now, Jack Quinn's son was ordained a priest. So everybody showed up. 50,000,000,000 people showed up. And everybody's kissing your hands. It's very sloppy, you know. Jesus. Boy, am I ever glad that in the States we give communion in the hands now. You don't have people picking their tongue at you for 16 hours. Yeah, woo, God, you know. Anyway, it's very sloppy, terribly unsanitary, you know. So I did, and of course I zapped everybody with grace and all kinds of things like that. And the next afternoon I'm out playing golf, and I realized I'm an unhappy hooker. And since I hadn't drank in 8 years, I reflected back on my youth, and I said, a pint of Mother Molson's Cure-All will take the hook out of the ball, and it did. And it worked magnificently well. And that night there was a party in my honor, of course, because I was just ordained 2 days at my sister's place. And I can remember to this second how irritated, mad, annoyed
I got that everybody else's glass was three-quarters full and mine was empty. But being an oblate father who was trained in missions to adapt to every type of human circumstance situation as possibly, I volunteered to be the bartender. To look after Martha, like Martha would say, is it time for another drink? No, George hasn't finished his drink yet. We'll wait. I said, what the hell's George come to these things for anyway, huh? Why the hell doesn't he stay home? He's ruining it. But I volunteered to be bartender. My mother then, Delaine the Flame, she's 82, got married again at 75. Fantastic woman, eh? She's off in the land of the midnight sun right now, just having a marvelous time. She was a widow then for 9 years. She said, son, drive me home. You know, someone had given me a brand new car. She says, aren't you coming in? I said, mother, a priest is never ordained for his own personal sanctification, but you must be about my father's business and build the kingdom of God and preach the good news in Labanu. I was thirsty. And I knew where I was going. Laval Salalac, a swinging place. Everybody's chronic alcohol. Beautiful people. Absolutely beautiful, right? And on my way out there, I pass Ruby Foo's nightclub. And that's where I used to hang out. And I see all the lights on, all the cars. I have terrific feelings of rejection. And I said, there must be some satanical, communistic-inspired infiltration movement going on in there. I better get in there and exercise the devil out of there. I had 20 more minutes to go. I could die of thirst. And I'm in a province that's 85% Catholic, but still very anti-clerical. I said, I can't go in like this with my Petey the Priest uniform on. But again, being an oblate father that's adaptable to every human circumstance, situation, condition, zap. And in 2 seconds, a loose flow in a line sports shirt. And I'm a shy guy. And it took me 14 seconds to get something going. And I did. And I was having a marvelous time, I think. And the next thing I know, it's daytime, I think, because I can see all these lights. And the nurse is saying, Father, don't swear. And I said, oh, spit. They know I'm a priest. And I opened my eyes, and I'm in a hospital, and I got a terrific pain in the back of my head later to find out there's 18 stitches there. And that's, I said, the last church I was in was Ruby Foo's. This has got to be Notre Dame de Grâce Hospital. So I finally mustered up enough courage. I said, nurse, what hospital is this? She said, St. Mary's Hospital, Father. And that's where I'd been less than 48 hours before zapping everybody with grace. Now I'm in the emergency room with 18 stitches in the back of my head. I don't even know how the hell I got there. Right? So as soon as she said that, I up and split and went to the party. I was 11 hours late, but that was the other people's loss, not mine. And as the spirits loosened the tongue, we started to find out what went on. And somebody called back to Ruby Foo's. And what I had done the night before is one of the Winnipeg Ballet Company's most intricate pirouette steps down the front staircase and out the front door. Head first, the front door was closed. That's 2 days ordained. The next 361 days, things picked up. They got a little more exciting. You know, are there times in your life when you know you should be sober as a judge, but because something you ate, the shrimp in the salad, you got a little bit tipsy? You know, so I was happening, and I went to my first parish, and I was there 3 days before I had to be carried home and lost the Volkswagen. I was allowed to function as a priest for 363 days, and I lost the Volkswagen 42 times. And that was the first time. And I said, maybe I'm working too hard. And I said, no, Vaughn, you've worked 3 days in your life. It can't be that. So you got to start playing. I said, you need some relaxation. We never played golf in the seminary, so I went to a golf club. They found out I was a priest. There was no green fees. They found out I was a priest. There were no bar fees. And I said, see, it's true. Seek first the kingdom of God, and everything else will be given to you. And that worked well, because I had to be back in the parish to hear confessions. You know, oh, God, confessions. That'd have a lot of fun, you know. Jesus, Lord. 90 people outside your box. Bless me, Father, if I had said that. Miss morning prayer. It's been a week since my last confession. I missed morning prayers 11 times. How the hell do you do that? I got up twice, 4 days in a row. And it goes on and on. The big numbers people and the one more or lessers, you know. Oh, God. Anyway, I had to be back in there. Until one day in July, they said, don't bother coming back. Someone's to take your place. They said that it's 10 minutes to eight in the morning, and that's when the party started. I went right upstairs and started the party. And that night, I met one of the most nincompooped, brain-damaged, narrow-minded imbeciles I've ever met in my life. But he happened to be a QPP, and that means Quebec Provincial Police. And he had accused me of making a U-turn, but I told him I took special pains ossifer and made it a V. And he said, you're coming with me. And he didn't know anything about canon law. And I spoke to him in Latin, Carissime Fratres Hodie Non Studiamus, and he didn't know anything about that. And I ended up in the slammer. I'm ordained 3 weeks, you know, and it means some other priest has to come over at about 3 o'clock in the morning and bail me out and all of that type of stuff. And again, I'd lost the Volkswagen. Where's the Volkswagen? Nobody knows where the Volkswagen is. You know, it was one of those dumb Volkswagens that didn't have a gas gauge on it, so nobody knew. And 4 priests were supposed to use it. And things like this came on. And again, are there times, you know, when you should be sober as a judge, but because of something you ate, you know, bam, you got a little bit tipsy again. By February, this was happening a little bit too often. I thought it was my apostolic zeal that everybody was reacting to because I would stay out all night and do the work of the kingdom. But evidently, some parishioners didn't think so, and they put me on the pledge. And I'm going to go through this one for you because this is a what I call a rationalization, an argument you have with yourself till you're losing time. And I wrote the pledge, and it was on February the 7th, 1965, and I said, my God, I can't ever drink until February the 7th, 1966. 1 year. I didn't know. It wasn't even worth the paper I'd written it on, but I didn't know that. And I waited till everybody said, boy, we straightened the kid out, didn't we? Yeah, and all the superiors were going, oh, give him a little muscle. All you got to give him is a little old hammer, give him the old school treatment, they'll say. And I waited till all their egos got very big, and they were all very pleased. And I was coming home as a ski instructor, and I was coming home with a bunch of college kids, and they said, excuse me, and they said, Father, aren't you going to stop and have a beer? And I'd been stopping and having a beer with these kids since I got there in June. Before, here it is, 8 or 9 months later, I said, my God, you know, these kids never saw me loaded because they all went home at midnight, and that's when I used to go to Hull, Quebec, and really build the kingdom of God. And I said, if I don't stop and have a beer with them, they're going to think I have prejudged them as taking away a perdition to go to Dante's Inferno, and that certainly I am not here to judge because Christ didn't come to judge, but he came to save, and that charity is the queen of all the virtues and far transcends any knuckle-minded Irish superior that says don't drink, so right now God wants me to drink. So I took 2 beers, and you know what happened? The worst thing that can ever happen to an alcoholic, absolutely nothing happened. And then I found out what those pockets were for in that long dress I used to wear all the time. I could put 2 pints of Mother Molson's Cure all down this side and 2 pints down this side and waddle on back to my room because all the booze was free because we got the vow of poverty and hope that I wouldn't meet the superior. And so then all of the drinking became subversive, you know. All of it became underground. And the superior would sit me down and say, are you drinking? But now I'm a classy moral theologian because I got 7 degrees. And he's an unjust aggressor. And when an unjust aggressor is asking you questions in the internal forum, you can give him what is called a mental reservation. Well, very, very good, isn't it? I was in AA 6 years before I found out that's lying. Right? So they'd say, are you drinking? I'd say, no! To you. See? No! And finally, they put him in the hospital. Thank God. Poor guy. Anyway, he went in at noon, and I visited him 45 minutes later because I knew the next morning I wasn't going to be in any shape at all to visit him because this is the guy that had all the muscle on me. And so I said, oh, Father Superior, isn't it terrible to see you here? Don't move. Anything you need, I'll get it. And that night I went out after confessions to be back in by 11 o'clock. And 11 o'clock came, and I said, oh, what the hell, as long as I make it by midnight, I'll be back in. By midnight, I came, oh, sweet blowing it, so what the hell. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm saying, if they're waiting for me, I'm really going to give them something to wait for. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, there were 1,200 people waiting for Mass, and I was supposed to say the Mass, and I arrived in at 11:15 in the morning, dead drunk, saying, I've been on a sick call. Well, they say alcoholics like to get a lot of attention. Try that one. We really want to see the fit hit the shan. Try that one for size. Yeah, then the next day I stayed drunk for about 2 days. I was scandalizing everybody at this tennis club because I was a tennis player. And I was just having a marvelous time, and they finally closed in and brought me to the superior, the big provincial. And he said, you're going away. And I said, thank God, I'm out of the salt mines. I'm getting my first obedience. That's absolutely magnificent. Where am I going? I hope I'm going to Victoria or out in British Columbia. It's nice out there. He says, you're going to Chicago. I said, oh, that's even better. And he says, Father Schrader flies with you. I said, uh-oh, no party. And so they packed me on a plane, and away I went. I thought I'm going away for 5 days, right? And I walk into this hospital in Dyer, Indiana, population 83 people, right? And the nurse says, isn't it nice to see you, Father? And all the nuns are there, and we go down on the carpeted hallways, onto the linoleum, then onto the cement. I start hearing familiar sounds that I had heard in my first year as a priest, like clickety clang clang. I used to visit jails, you know, clang, 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 and all this. Then I'm saying, uh-oh. Then I hear a big boom behind me. The door's closed, and I'm in a very dark, deep, damp, dismal dungeon type of a place. The room is 7 feet by 9 feet, and the nurse, absolutely gorgeous, beautiful nurse. Talent like you wouldn't believe. She played defensive end with the Chicago Bears for 9 years. And she said to me, suit, shirt, this is a bib, shoes, belt, breviary, everything, right? And I said, it's getting warm. Do you think we could open a window? She said, I'll go get the crank. I said, my God, I'm locked up. She said, that is right. I said, what brought me here? And to myself, I knew enough to say booze. And then I was issued my little paper suit with the numbers on the shoes and a hat and one of those honeymoon jackets that never closes up and I always walk around this. Smiling at the world. And there I was. And the next, that was June the 16th, 1965. And Sunday came, I'm suspended. Now, that means you can't say mass anymore. I got you on the shelf. Ecclesiastical cinctures and all of that type of stuff. And it's Sunday and I got to go to church. Roman Catholic priest, he's, I got to go to church. So I said, I want to go to church. And it's a nice Catholic nut house. It was a Twitch farm, I found out. And so they bring the two bodyguards, and I'm in my little suit here, you know, kind of walk along by the wall, and I get in there. Now, here I am, God's gift to Christianity, you know, the ex-millionaire, the ex-pro athlete, now 7 degrees, all of this stuff going on. I've been all over the world 3 times, all of this type of stuff, and there I am sitting there. And so they bring the two bodyguards, and I'm in my little suit here, you know, kind of walk along by the wall, and I get in there. Now, here I am, God's gift to Christianity, you know, the ex-millionaire, the ex-pro athlete, now 7 degrees, all of this stuff going on. I've been all over the world 3 times, all of this type of stuff, and there I am sitting there in my little paper suit with all of the rest of the psychos with their socks rolled down over their gray tennis shoes, and they got spitballs in their ear, you know, going, yay, Jesus, they're all singing. It's the only... It's the only time in my life I sang Faith of the Fathers and I wasn't the only one off key, you know? It really was. And I was sitting there crying. And the next two, crying. You know, this is what, how, what in the world brought me here? You know, and I wouldn't tell anybody I was there. Nobody knew I was there. Everybody knew I was there, but I, you know, I wasn't going to tell my family. The Oblate Fathers had already told my family. The next Tuesday night was June the 22nd. The nurse said, the doctor wants you to go to the AA meeting tonight. I said, what? Me? With all these holy oils of ordination hardly dry on my hands, all these degrees, you want me to go to those drunks and get help? I said, nurse, you've just had a psychotic break. Well, get some shock treatment. But being a con artist, I said, well, that, see, I had 4 more days to go in the hospital. I said, will that help me get out of the hospital? She said, yes, it will. I said, I'll go. I would have gone to Child Molesters Anonymous that night if I thought I was going to get out of the hospital. So I went, you know, and I'll always remember this. The guy who met me, you know, Frank, the most miserable guy in the world, he was smiling, you know, and he was laughing, and he was big, tall string of misery looking at me, and I can always remember his teeth, big, shiny teeth, you know, looked like my horse. I have a champion horse called Jim's Light Talk. He looked just like him, and he's shaking my head, really glad to see you, you know, and I'm looking at him, oh, and I go, I'm Vaughn, I cough over the father part, and I go in and I sit down. Hell, I didn't know it's a closed meeting. I'm an alky, I'm an alky, I'm an alky, I'm an alky. Everyone, well, she, I'm an alky too. What the hell? You know? So everybody else says, I'm a joiner. When the heat's on, you join everything. You know, don't worry, honey, I joined AA. Don't worry about a thing. Keep the divorce papers away. So I feel I got to get out of this hospital somehow. I got a lot of things to do. Anyway, so now I'm a young priest. I used to speak fast when I was immature, but now I'm mature, I don't speak fast anymore. And I used to think that was funny. In Chicago, I used to say funny words like out, about, and house, and they all break up when you say that, you know? And so now I am a little Petey the priest in my penguin outfit, and they thought that was cute, so they used to haul me all over, you know, giving AA talks. I gave 40 AA talks in my first 2 months in AA. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about, but everybody kept laughing, and I could get out of the nut house. You know, the two guys would come and sign me out, and they'd come bring me back in. The nurse would go, yeah, he's okay, sign him in. And I thought AA was really great because people laughed at my jokes, and they really were a fantastic bunch of people, and you could get away from the psychos all day long, weaving baskets and making wallets. This is the honest to God's truth. I'm a pro athlete, and I still play. I still run approximately 10 miles every day. I'm the star goaltender with the Flying Father hockey team that plays all over the world and all kinds of things like that. And I end up playing on a baseball team with a cotton ball this big, right? I cross my heart and hope to die if any word I say is a lie. You know, the nuts used to hit it, and so that, and they'd run to third base, and they never knew the difference, and they wouldn't hurt themselves. If I hit it once, a beautiful one, I'm rounding second base, I meet my own teammate coming the other way. Hi, hi! Jesus! Whoa! You know? That's true! A great big guy, I said to myself, oh, God, I hope it's not going to be a tie at home plate, you know? So now I'm going to AA. They're carting me all over the place. And they're a wonderful bunch of people. Absolutely marvelous, you know. But I've never seen them before. And they're never going to see me again. Because in 3 more days, I'm leaving for Canada. And I'll never see them again. And they're fantastic people. Lovely. But I don't belong here. I've never lost a wife. You know, and there's a little bit of His Majesty the baby that's alive in all of us. You know, we keep going to AA meetings like we go to a zoo to find animals we don't have to identify with. So I was quite comfortable, right? So, you know, I got, fifth day came, I was still there. Somebody had given me a book like this. This is the big book, by the way, in case you don't know, gang. You know, these are the 12 steps and 12 traditions. Yeah, okay. Gave me one like it. This is a new one. And I said, what the hell? I got degrees in epistemology and ontology and metaphysics and all that. I'm not going to read. That's for common, ordinary drunks. So I just left it on my bed table, right? And the alcoholics in that hospital stayed there for 14 days and left. 4 months later, I'm still there. And they're carrying the drunks in again. They're the same guys that have been in there 3 times, right? Oh, my old buddies. My old cellmates from the Twitch farm. You know, we used to play and putty together. And weave baskets and make wallets. And they carry them in. They'd say, Jesus, Quinn, are you still here? You're really sick. So. So I opened the book. How to Get Out of the Nut House. Release from Twitch Farms. God, I looked all over. You know, what's the secret to success around here? You know, where is it? And that's how I started reading the book. Now, it wasn't a bad book. I was ready to rewrite it. Straighten it out a little bit. And after 6 months, I was called to Guest House, which is the Rehabilitation Center for Roman Catholic Alcoholic Priests and Brothers in Lake Orion, Michigan. And they said, Mr. Ripley, who has since passed on in 1974, was the founder. And he said, I'll give you till 6 o'clock to get here. I said, how am I going to get there? And he says, if you want to get here, you'll get here. So I got somebody to drive me from Chicago to Detroit area. And I went in, and he says, I don't even believe you when you had your last drink. Tomorrow you're going back in the hospital. I said, what? Hospital? I'm just out of it. Look at me. I'm in perfect shape. Been winning tennis matches down there. Well, it's hard to win tennis matches in a nut house, you know. They didn't even know which end of the racket to use. It didn't make any difference. He says, I don't even believe you when you had your last drink. I said, what do you mean? I'm God's gift to AA. I mean, I know all this stuff. I'm going to rewrite the big book. And he says, tomorrow you go back in the hospital. Because I don't believe you when you had your last drink. I said, oh, my God. So I go back into another hospital, St. Joseph's Hospital in Mount Clemens. And for the next 3 days, they took tests of everything you can possibly give a test of. Every hour on the hour, the nurse was there and got something. They didn't even put grease on my hair and put all kinds of wires in there to see if the holes were as big as cheese yet in my brain. And the last morning I'm there, the most moving experience in my whole life, 4 enemas in one morning. I said, hey, Doc, I've been in AA 6 months. I know it's a 3-fold disease, and you're trying to get my soul. But since I had already spent 6 months in the lockup, they didn't have to work on me too long. They only kept me there 7 months. So my 5 days turned into 57 weeks. And then I was assigned out here to Edmonton, Alberta. I started becoming interested in alcoholism. And they said, why don't you do something to get trained? And so I took a year off, and I worked in 22 different buckets, swank tanks, jitter joints, funny farms, laughing academies, bureaus, divisions, and foundations of boozology. And I went back to Detroit to visit Guest House because I had to visit there twice a year, my first 2 years of sobriety. And Mr. Ripley says, go down to the Skid Row area. There's somebody trying to get something going. I did in October of 1967. I walked into a building, and it was absolutely fascinating. There were people cheering the World Series in a baseball game, and there was no TV set. You know, and other guys were watching pink polka-dotted alligators and turkeys with straw hats, and other guys were saying, move over and let the Santa Fe come down the middle aisle. And I thought that was very exciting, and I stayed. And that's where I am now as director and put that program together, which is called Sacred Heart Center in Detroit. And there's 315 alcoholics in the different facilities every day, live-in, long-term program. And that's what I've been doing for the past 11 years. Now, in that position, a lot of people come to me and say, Father, can I have a staff of 105 alcoholics on my staff? That's why I can play all the time. That's all I do now. That's why I don't even have a real job anymore. It's really neat. You know, I just play hockey and play my banjos. I got 5 antique fire trucks and 5 St. Bernard dogs. And I just have a lot of fun playing.
Yeah, you don't think it's true. You said, this is my 11th weekend in a row on the road doing something. You know, giving sports talks at these beautiful AA talks. I mean, beautiful people in AA. I don't know what the talks are worth. But anyway, people come to me and say, Father, I don't know what happened. I've been in AA eight years and I've just had a slip. I said, well, how'd you do that? He says, I don't know. I was the best 12-stepper in my group. And I say, what's the 12-step? He says, saving other drunks. I say, no, it's not. He says, working with other alcoholics. I say, no, it's not. He says, rescuing other alcoholics. I say, no, it's not. I said, where's your big book? Oh, hell, my big book. I gave it to my first pigeon 8 years ago because he needed it more than I did. I said, well, where is it? I don't have one. So we say, turn to page 60 here, and let's look at the 12th step, and it says, having had a spiritual awakening. And he goes, oh, I knew you were going to do that because you're a priest and you start Bible thumping me and everything else like that. I said, did you have a spiritual awakening? He says, hell no. I looked for God all over. I worked 8 hours a day, and I sweated 8 hours a day, and I fought booze 8 hours a day, and I slept, and I looked all over for God, and I never saw anything. I say, well, did you take your third step with somebody? What do you mean, take your third step? I said, well, here, right here on page 63, right there, we found it desirable to take this spiritual step with another understanding person. The wording was quite optional, voicing it without, as long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. That's important. Voicing it, you know, that means you got to use your vocal cords and speak. Because alcoholics, like many other people, we don't have the corner in the market of living, have great imminent action ideas, eh? The idea stays up here, starts up here and stays there, and we don't do a darn thing about it. And I've never known one person in the 12,000, over 12,000 people that I've had in treatment, plus I do this every other weekend of my life, that's gotten well thinking about it. I didn't. Hell, I went out and got 7 degrees, became ordained, I still got drunk. You know, and I could stand here right now and talk to you for the next 3 hours of what happens when a monoamine oxidized inhibitor gets ingested into your liver that has an extraordinary compound of alcohol dehydrogenase causing the oxidation of alcohol into acetaldehyde, acetic acid, carbon dioxide into water, and the mitochondria in between the cells in the liver with the norepinephrine and the serotonin up in your brain, I have a euphoric experience, and I could die drunk tomorrow. Because this book tells us it's not knowledge that keeps us sober. You know, it's the internalization of the program. You know, the regular attendance of meetings and the internalization of the steps. You see, so many people I come across think an AA commitment means I go to one meeting a week, I listen to a drunkologue, I drink stale coffee, eat hard donuts, and still sit in a smoke-filled room and by damn, they better get me well. And it's a heck of a lot more than that. I say we don't even join AA. We must live it. I joined, eh? We all joined, you know. You know how I joined AA? Same way as I'm going to get in heaven. Back in my fanny out of hell. The heat's on. Oh, yeah, we join. But what's happening inside me in between the steps? In between the meetings with the steps? That's what's important. No, it's very easy to say, this is where I'm going to live, but we're not going to voice it to anybody. We're not going to take the third step with anybody. We're not going to say, hey, here's the checkmark system. This is what you can check me on, and when I get off base, you can tell me. You know, so many people think it's an individual program, and it's a selfish program, and they interpret that to mean I can do whatever the heck I want with it. And it doesn't mean, I know I do retreats, I've just finished 9 retreats, and I hear this all the time. You practice your program, I'll practice my program. Don't tell me, take your own inventory, I'll take my inventory. You practice your program, everybody's got their own program, that's not what it says here. On page 59, it doesn't say, 58, rarely have we seen a person fail who has done whatever the heck they want with this program. Only taking to heart those things which would be convenient, fitting, and pleasurable for them to do. And of course, casting aside anything which might demand a little spiritual growth, pain, or change. These people are sure to get well. It doesn't say that. Sure, it is a selfish program and an individual program, and that means if Vaughn Quinn does the things that are prescribed in these 45 pages, page 58 to 103, by the way, I could go to the American Cancer Foundation and say, I have a book with 45 pages in it, and if anybody lives by what's prescribed in this book, I can guarantee they'll never again suffer from cancer. There won't be any deaths. You can take all the money that you're spending on cancer and put it in some other type of human services. How much do you think I could sell those pages for? $10 billion. There's 45 pages in this book which absolutely guarantee to the alcoholic, to the Al-Anon, to the Al-Ateen, that the people live by what is prescribed in pages 58 to 103 guarantee that they never again will suffer any of the ravages of alcoholism, to the collaterals, family illness, and everything else. And my own personal thing is maybe, I'll be generous, maybe 10% work it. Read it. Keep working it over and over and over again. I read this stuff, like Bill, every day. Or Lou, right? And I'm standing up here tonight, and you know, there's a lot of people in front of me, and I could change some people's lives, and that's very, very sacred. And I'm not up here to tell you about a drunkalogue, you know, or just, you know, take you on a 2-hour geographical tour of the 33 bathrooms I threw up in. No, I get very irritated when I go to AA meetings and people just sit around and they talk about the drunk that happened 12 years ago. And they're not sharing with people how they get well. For God's sakes, share with people how you're getting well. Where's the hope? Where's the faith? Where's the love? That's what people come for. That's what a spiritual fellowship is. It demands participation. It demands self-revelation. But people come to get well. And share with them how you're getting well. That's what rubs off. Not to continue hide behind. I could take you on some of the wildest drunkalogues in the world. What good would that do? And in the 12th step, having had the spiritual awakening, they say, what is it? I don't know what it is. I looked all over for God. Turn to page 569 in the big book. That's a very important number. That's the address of Sacred Heart Center in Detroit, 569 East Elizabeth. Took me a day and a half to rearrange the city, but I was able to do it with no problem whatsoever. And it talks about William James, the father of American psychology, talks of the spiritual awakening as an education process. From the Latin word educare. And that means to lead out of a person a hierarchy of values which were once there, but have gone dormant, asleep, or have been deadened because of the progression of the symptomatology of a primary disease, alcoholism. I can talk to you about the externals, people, place, and things. They're the funny ha-has. The guy who used to be the car buff, his car was always worth 100 points in any show he put it in. 8 years later, it looks like a 1928 Whippet. Or Sally the gardener, God, her garden was always in super shape. You could never find a weed at all. 9 years later, weeds up to your waist. Those are the external things. All the hobbies and interests that we've just died. Now get to some of the real things in life, eh? The interpersonal relationships. Husbands, wives, marriages, children, in-laws, everybody. Personal friends. Change all of that. What's this book say? Broken, thwarted path of interpersonal relationships left behind us. Those are values. Now talk to the real values, eh? Dignity. Self-respect. Self-esteem, freedom, all stripped. That's what alcohol strips from every one of us. I was given the gift of an ordination. I spent 8 full years getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5.5 hours every day in common prayer, put 7 more degrees behind my name, and what happened? Alcohol stripped me of every one of those things until I ended up in that real deep, dark, damp, dismal dungeons of despair. Just crying out with all of the anguish. The things I told you were hilariously funny now. They were not funny in 1965 because I woke up crying every morning for 6 months saying, God, just give me enough guts to hang in one more day because I wanted out. What I really wanted to do was get out of the obelisk and get my money back, and I was going to build my own church on Waikiki Beach and build the kingdom of God the way it should have been built. But they didn't let me out, thank God. Oh, that's, and it says, having had this spiritual awakening, how? God doesn't say, you know, go bang your head against the brick wall. It says, as the, T-H-E. It doesn't say as a, If it said as a result of these steps, it would be a one-time, catastrophic, world-shattering, bone-crushing event where Angel Gabriel would come down with his 26-piece orchestra of 7-foot-long trumpets going, da-da-da-da-da! Don't worry, Bond, you'll never drink again. That's what I thought should have happened, but it didn't happen. It says the, T-H-E. You know what that big word means? Continuous action must be taken. Continuous action. It doesn't mean you go over Monday till Friday and take the weekends off. You know? Well, I've been a good boy for 5 days, so, you know, it's time to... Well, not right now, God. You know, continuous action must be taken. All of these 11 steps as the result of these steps. And I go all over the country and I keep hearing there's no musts in AA. It's an individual program. Sure, it's an individual program. If I keep doing what these pages say and keep going to regular closed meetings every week of my life, there's a darn good chance I'm going to stay happy, free, happy, serene, and peaceful. Because those are the promises of AA. You know, AA is not just, as I see it anyway, a Ouija board type of thing. You come in and just hang around and figure you're going to get it by osmosis or something, just, you know. On page 83, it tells us, if you are painstaking with this portion of the program, these are the promises of AA. You will know. You are going to know new freedom, new happiness. You will comprehend the word serenity and will know peace. How many AAs came into this fellowship knowing freedom, happiness, peace, and serenity? How many Al-Anons knowing freedom, happiness, peace, and serenity? When you were responding to the uncontrolled drinking situation, the disease of alcoholism, with nothing but worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. And everything I say with regards to these steps is applicable to the Al-Anons and the Al-Ateens, because sometimes I give talks and I start talking about what people should be doing, and somebody's sitting there going, you didn't do that. You do that. Hey, there's no must in AA. Balderdash, there's all kinds of them. Read the book, page 62. Somebody count. Count with me. Okay. Joanne, we alcoholics must rid ourselves of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Whoops, the old book's falling apart here. Page 66. We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than we could wish alcohol away. Page 69. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm. On page 73, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long and happily. Those of us belonging to religious order denominations which demand we talk to certain people must, of course, want to go to the properly appointed authorities. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. And when we can't find somebody to take the fifth step with immediately, we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. On page 78, we must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go. On page 79, these are things we have to do if we've lost our reputation or faced jail, but we have to be willing to do that. We must not shrink at anything. On page 80, you know, whatever our deals turn out to be, we ask God to help the drastic step as indicated. We must not shrink. Here's a very important one on page 82. Certainly, we must stay sober. You know, a lot of people coming out of treatment centers saying, well, I'm only drinking beer now. Yeah, not fair enough. Don't worry, sweetie. You said I'm a hard alcoholic, but I can drink beer or eat pills. You know, what's the difference? Oh, okay. You know? Certainly we must stay sober. On page 83, we must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic of anyone. You know, and on page 83 at the top, we must take the lead in the period of reconstruction that's ahead of us. On page 85, listen to this one. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly, but we must go further, and that means more action. Certainly, we must be careful not to drift into worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. On page 89, when dealing with other people, this is an experience we must not miss, and he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. How many am I at? 21? Page 99, there's about 8 there. There's all kinds of them. You know, the Ten Commandments are pretty, like our friend was saying, you know, kind of watch what you're doing, you know, give honor to God, don't adore false gods. They're kind of non-directive therapy type of stuff, you know? You know, adore your father and mother because they're the only two you got, and they did the best with what they could do when they had you and all of that type of stuff. And, you know, don't steal the things that don't belong to you because you'll most probably end up in the slammer. And, you know, be very careful where you're sleeping around because it gets very sticky. And, you know, it can get embarrassing, and it's kind of all those types. These steps are a heck of a lot more directive than that. We're talking about life and death. And I didn't come all these miles today to sit here and just amuse you and talk about what type of wallpaper to put on the kitchen wall so that it would make it match the rest of the house, or what type of toothpaste to use, you know, so you won't get cavities. What we're talking about is life and death. And yes, I'll encouch it in funny terms, because if I really tell you what it's like, you know as well as I do. I live in the third largest county in the United States of America, where 0.88% of the alcoholics get any help whatsoever. That means right now, the last day of June, there's 99.2 going down the tubes. You know, at Christmas time, people who had left my center, I had 12 suicides in less than 2 weeks. Not one of them over 28 years old. You know, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about life and death. You know? And so I put it in funny terms, because if I don't, well, we'd all be jumping off roofs, and, you know, God, it would be so terrible. But that's what this program is about. And when we get into the steps, you know, there's lots of musts, and people keep saying, well, I wonder why I'm not feeling happy. Well, I'm practicing my program my way. You practice it your way. Then you don't have to do that. You know, just be comfortable. Just turn it over to higher power, that's all. So we look at the steps, you know, and that means the spiritual awakening means the values which God gave you. You want to know what God's will is for you? Let me tell you once and for all, that you be happy. That's what it is. Every one of you is a beautiful, lovable person. You know, with a degree of excellence in you that's got to be developed. And I keep going around to AA meetings and to AA retreats. I was just at one, AA Cochran. How's everybody in Cochran? Boy, it's really nice in Cochran. Beautiful mountains. How's everybody? We're all right. Well, what's happening in Cochran here? What's happening? Beautiful part of the country, mountains and everything. Nothing. Well, what are you doing to make life exciting? Nothing. You go to AA meeting? Yeah, I go. What else do you do? Nothing. Why? I'm an alcoholic. You know? No! Dullsville, it's, you know, I want to shoot him, you know. When we drank at the beginning, eh, we had more fun because that was the effects of the alcohol, eh, always as an upper. God, you couldn't dance with a darn five drinks. You made Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire look like they had multiple sclerosis, you know. You couldn't sing, but you got down a father's mustache in the Red Garden, and you were the hit of the party, and you know, you cleaned up all around the place, and you drove five people home because they had too much to drink, and you really were where the action was, and you were a better fighter and a better car driver and a better lover and a better salesman. When I had a bottle of Hagen Haig, when I was writing a sermon, I'd make Fulton Sheen look like he had a speech impediment and couldn't even do anything, and things really went. And that's true. And now we got sobriety, a gift from God. There's not one of us in this room that deserved it. Not one of us in this room that worked for it. Not one of us in this room that got some clear, distinct idea saying, yes, I think I better quit. Hell, they have to lock me up. And unless this sobriety becomes more meaningful, more purposeful, more rich, more fulfilling, more fun, more pizzazz, we're going to get bored and go back to the drinking because we want to change the way we feel or go back to something else. And to get this quality of life, you know, that means action. That means the internalization of the steps into the guts and into the legs, so we start doing things to make this world a better place to live in. What are we doing to contribute? What are we putting back in the pot? So we all have to do it. You know, you develop the degrees of excellence in you. Quit playing the negative tapes and start doing some good positive things. The only way you are going to get good positive feelings about yourself is consequential to doing good positive action. And it works. Now, you don't all have to be as crazy as I am and have five antique fire trucks and five St. Bernards and play on hockey teams all over the world and play in banjo bands and run 10 miles every day and do all that type of stuff. No. But you know, you can't sit there and keep going, nothing, I'm bored. You know, and that's what the steps will teach you, freedom. You know, I'm not talking about just concepts up in the sky. You know, AA is an action program that has to be internalized. in action. Freedom doesn't mean you go rollicking down the street, you know, hop, skip, jumping, and just going, yahoo, I got nothing to do. No, freedom is broken down into concrete action. First of all, tenderness. In word, the way we touch people, the way we talk to people, the way we listen to people, the way we be for people, the risks that we're willing to take. It means empathy and compassion. That means no judgments, no moral judgments on people. None of this what I call restricted conversions in AA, where you end up adoring God, which is yourself. And if anybody does anything different, shoot them down. You know, you hear that all the time. Oh, those young kids are lucky. They've never suffered like we had to suffer. Wow, you know, I've been in AA 79 years. Well, you're lucky. I spilled more booze in my tie than you ever drank in your life. You don't even know what pain is. You know, well, let me tell you, I've been in this business 13 years now. I know those 19-year-olds have been to hell and back five times more than I ever had to go. No. And it doesn't mean you're going to judge people. It means you're going to accept them and you're going to try to love them just for what they are.